turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened?
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generation legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 112, and this is going to be a recording of the message that I delivered to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, from Judges chapter 6 regarding Gideon, chapter 6 and chapter 7, about Gideon as a judge and what we can learn from that about fear. And the passage is full of the theme of fear, and so it's a good way to look into the insight the scriptures have regarding fear. So in just a moment, you're going to be able to hear that. Before we do that, I want to direct your attention to just a few announcements. First of all, make sure that you're a registered user of the website. This enables you to access the comments section. It also enables you to have regular updates anytime that there is a change to the website. You'll be notified by email. That way, that's the best way for you to be able to keep up to date on what's going on the website. Secondly, make sure that you are telling your friends and family, spreading the word about Legacy Podcast. We are, of course, always looking to have some more inquiries as to listeners. And so if you enjoy the show, tell some other people about it. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Like us on Facebook, those kinds of things. And then thirdly is visit our sponsors, or not our sponsors, but our affiliates. And we've got several of them listed on the website on the center right column. And the two up for today, first one is Liberty Classroom. Liberty Classroom is a great work that is designed to help those who are homeschoolers, or those who just want to brush up on college level material, or those who just have an interest in the areas of history and economics, that kind of thing. Maybe those of you who have been taught history but taught it from a typical humanistic perspective in the public school systems, and you want to get a more well-rounded, non-biased perspective, then the best way to do that is to connect with the Liberty Classroom. You can have Western Civilization course, two courses in that. There's two courses in American history. There's a course in logic, and there's a course in Austrian economics or free market capitalism. And all of that you can access online, whether it be through an audio format or through a video format. You can download notes. You can interact on a forum with the professors and ask questions. And just a great resource. All of that for $99 is incredible. So check out Liberty Classroom. Second up is visit Gurney's. And those of you who are making preparations for your spring gardens, it's a great time to be able to find out what Gurney's has to offer. They have a wide selection of various kinds of plants and trees and shrubs and seeds. And they have some exotics as well as some regular varieties. And they always have really excellent shipping and excellent costs associated with the shipping. And they are some of the least expensive places to buy seeds that I know of. So check out Gurney's. And then finally, if you like the show and you want to support the show, the best way to do that is become a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is $30 a year. With that, you have exclusive access to the members-only website that has on it downloadable material that you can read and access. It also has access to vendors that help support the show and have offered discounts to various programs that they have. And you'll want to make sure you check out all that is available at the Legacy Partner program on our website. And then if you like the show enough to support the show, a best way to do that is become a Legacy Partner. I encourage you to do that. And that takes care of the introductory material. So now let's go ahead and listen to the message that I delivered to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, regarding Gideon and the fear associated with the passage in chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Judges.
You know, fear is everywhere in the world. We probably have had some sort of fear even this week. And probably we will have fear arise in our hearts this next week. It's something that we deal with on a regular basis. And yet, I think it's important for us to be reminded in the scriptures of the proper place for fear and how that plays in our lives. In preparation for this message, I went to the internet and I searched for fear. And you might want to look at this website. It's quite humorous and tragic at the same time. But there is a list of phobias at phobialist.com. And I'm just going to mention a few of them. There's actually 68 just in the A's. All right, so if you go through the whole alphabet, there's probably 1,000 or so of these. And here are just a few that I picked out. There's agatophobia. That's the fear of insanity. Now, I don't know whether it's the fear of becoming insane or whether it's the fear of people who are insane or just the fear of the thought of it. I'm not sure, but there's agatophobia. There's alienophobia. That's the fear of garlic. I don't know whether that's a fear of eating garlic or smelling garlic or growing garlic or what, but that wouldn't work in our household. We like garlic. So, and then there's allodoxfolia. That's the fear of opinions. So I guess if you're around somebody, and I hope no one has any of these, okay? I'm just picking these randomly, okay? But can you imagine if someone had that around you and you started to state your opinion? No, I can't hear the opinion. And then there's anablephobia. It's the fear of looking up. That would work for me. I'd get a shine off the top of my head. And then there's anglophobia. You might have guessed what that is. That's the fear of England. Of course, that's what the colonists said. I don't know. And then there's a pyrophobia. That's the fear of infinity. The fear of infinity. Okay. There's apotemnophobia. That's the fear of persons with amputations. I don't know about some of these. And then there's I can't even pronounce this one. Erakebuterophobia. That's the fear of peanut butter sticking to the top of your mouth. It's an actual phobia. Can you believe it? I mean, I've had peanut butter stick to the top of my mouth, but I'm not afraid of it. I mean, I just get it off and eat it. It's good. And then arimophobia. That's the fear of numbers. Some of you probably have had that, right? Math class. There's ataxiophobia. That's the fear of ataxia or muscular incoordination. And then there's allophobia. It's the fear of flutes. I'm just reading these things, okay? I don't know whether it's their fear of the sound of them or the fear of playing them or, you know, whatever it is. And then there's the aurophobia. That's the fear of gold. Now, if any of you have that fear, I'll take your gold, okay? And then the last one I'll mention today is auroraphobia. That's the fear of the northern lights. I don't know if they're just scared to look at them or scared of the process of the northern lights or what. But you could look at all these lists and probably wear yourself out and look at all the different phobias that are out there. And certainly some of them can be humorous, but I suspect those who actually have those phobias is not too humorous to them. But nonetheless, we deal with fear in our lives. It's just something that is customary to come across. And so what we need to have is we need to have a healthy view of fear from the scriptures. And when we look at chapter 6 and chapter 7 of the book of Judges, there is one theme that continually shows itself, and that is the theme of fear. And it occurs from various different people in various different circumstances. And it is something that I think is the theme of these passages, even though there are other themes as well. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to look at seven truths about fear. Seven truths about fear. And the first one is this. Idolatrous fear results in the discipline of God, or discipline from God. Idolatrous fear results in discipline from God. In chapter 6, verses 1 through 10, what we find is that we find the Midianites have started to oppress Israel. And for 7 years, they had been oppressing Israel. And it's interesting to note what picture we find here in verse 2. And it says, "And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, because the Midianites, the children of Israel, made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains." So it's a pitiful sight. God's people were supposed to dwell in this promised land. It was supposed to be a land of fruitfulness and promised blessings. And they were supposed to have rain that came down out of the sky rather than the Nile River watering the ground. And so it was just supposed to be this land of plenty. And instead, the picture that we see here is that we see the Israelites hiding away in dens and caves, because of these marauding forces of the Midianites that would come in. And it says that during harvest time, just as the grain was about to be harvested, the Midianites would ride in on their camels, and they would take away all the grain so that the Israelites were impoverished. So verse 3, "So it was, whenever Israel had sown, Midianite would come up, also Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it." So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So here again, we see this cycle that occurs in the Judges over and over again. Because of the evil of the people, God hands them over to some of the people that surrounded them. And in this case, it's the Midianites and the Amalekites. And so the Amalekites and the Midianites oppress them. And because of the oppression, then the Israelites call out to God. And God then raises up a deliverer. And so verse 7, it says, "And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I have brought you up out of Egypt and brought you to the house, out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of all who oppress you, and drove them out before you and gave you this land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice.'" So why was it that they were oppressed by the Midianites and the Amalekites? Why was it they were living in dens and caves and had no prosperity in the land because of the devastation of those who were around them? It's because they had joined in worshiping the gods of the people around them. So when we, out of fear, worship gods that are foreign, gods that we are not to worship, just as the Israelites did here, God brings discipline into our lives. You have heard, of course, the scriptures in the first of the Ten Commandments that says, "You shall have no other God before you." And the second one, "You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for the Lord your God is a jealous God." And then over and over again in the scriptures, we see God discipline in the nations of Israel because they feared the gods of the Canaanites and the peoples around them. And so we look at this and we say, That was the gods of the Canaanites, and the Israelites shouldn't be worshiping them. Well, do we not have in our own life situations where we place something ahead of God in our lives and in our worship? You know, we don't have idolatry as Gideon did, but there is a subtle idolatry that is in our society, and it's called superstition. You see, superstition is placing some kind of power on some inanimate object. And that's similar to what they did. They would raise up some pole or something and make it carved and make it look like some kind of deity or something. And they would bow down and worship this deity as though that pole had some kind of power. And the similar thing occurs when it comes to superstitions in our culture. How many of you all have ever referred to beginner's luck? Playing a game, you just teach someone the game and they beat you. You know, I was just beginner's luck. Well, that's superstition. There's no such thing as beginner's luck, is there? Of course not. What about finding that lucky penny, right? Oh, you find the penny on the ground, pick it up. Oh, your lucky day now, right? That's superstition. There's no power in that penny. Or what about not walking under the ladder? I walk under the ladder all the time. And yet, because of superstition, people refuse to walk under a ladder. What about the black cat crossing your path? supposed to bring you bad luck, right? There's no power in that cat that gives you any kind of bad luck. What about a rabbit's foot? Bring you good luck. Or what about the concept that bad luck comes in threes? You ever heard that saying before? Superstition. Or what about breaking the mirror? Superstition. What about the use of 666 in all its various forms? Now, we know in the scriptures, of course, the word or the number 666 refers to the beast in Revelation. And yet, because of that, our culture has developed this concept of not having 666 in different things. And so, anytime you see that, people start to freak out. No, no. What about knocking on wood, right? Well, I'm not going to do that. Superstitions, right? Or making a wish with a wishbone. Superstitions. Crossing your fingers, right? Kids do that all the time, right? Sure, I'll give you that. They have their fingers crossed the whole time. What about no umbrellas on the inside of the house or inside of a building or something like that? Superstition. And then there's a special concern for Friday the 13th, right? Everybody's scared of Friday the 13th. Comes around a couple times a year. In fact, 13 number itself has some superstition associated with it. You go to a lot of hotels and a lot of high-rise buildings, and you try to push number 13 on the buttons, and there's not one. Now, I don't know what they're thinking. There's a 13th floor. It comes right after the 12th floor. They just call it 14. I mean, it's not like they're doing away with the 13th floor. They're just doing away with the button 13. But that's because of superstition. And we live in a culture just filled with superstition. We just buy into this stuff without even thinking about it. Well, that's the same thing the Israelites were doing. They were just buying into the culture around them, worshiping these gods that had no power whatsoever, but placing upon those gods power. And as a result of that, God brings discipline upon them. And the same thing is true with us. He will bring discipline upon us if we put power on something that shouldn't be any power on. No, there's only that kind of power on God. We must put all such nonsense away from us, or the discipline of God is sure to come. Second principle, or second truth about fear here in this passage, is that trusting in oneself results in the fear of failure. Trusting in oneself results in the fear of failure. We see this in verses 11 through 24. And in verses 11 through 12, what we find is that an angel appears to Gideon and basically calls him into the ministry, or calls him into leading the nation of Israel, just as he does with all the other judges. And so in verse 11 it says, "Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress, in order to hide it from the Midianites." So again, see this picture, this pitiful picture. Here's this guy who's hiding in a cave in a wine press, who's hiding away the wheat that he's stored up so that the Amalekites and the Midianites don't come in and take it away. So verse 12, "An angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.'" All right, now we got to pause here for a second. Get this picture. Here's this young guy. He's hiding in a cave, trying to thresh his wheat in a cave because he's scared that the Midianites are going to come and take him away. And an angel appears to him and says, "You mighty man of valor." He's thinking to himself, "Wait a second. Who are you talking to?" So verse 13, "Gideon said to him, 'Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us?'" You ever said that? A tragedy? Something occurs and you think to yourself, "Where is God in the midst of all that?" Well, that's what he's thinking. He's thinking to himself, "Look, here I am hiding away in a cave. We have no money. We're trying to make a little bit of bread out of this barley that we've saved. And we can't make it. Where is God in the midst of this?" He says, goes on, "And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." He's saying, "God's given up on us. Where is God in the midst of all of this?" And then verse 14, "Then the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in this might of yours.'" Now again, so far he's not been very mighty, has he? And God's saying, "Go in this might of yours. Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" Verse 15, "So he said to him, 'Oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel?' Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. In other words, he's like, look, I'm the youngest, I am the weakest in my father's house, and my father's house is the weakest of the tribes of Israel, and of the tribes of Israel all under persecution. How am I going to deliver the nation? You see, what was his problem? His problem was he was focused on himself, wasn't it? He's saying, how can I deliver the nation? And so, because he was focused on himself, he had a fear of failure. Verse 16, and the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. Then he said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talks with me. And so he has this doubt arise about his ability to be able to lead the nation into victory. And so God has to reassure him and say, no, I am going to be with you. I promise that I am going to be with you. And so in verses 17 and 18, he petitioned God, Gideon petitions God to wait for him while he goes and makes an offering. He makes this offering, brings it back. And by the way, the amount of barley that he gets together was probably all that he had left to make bread. And he makes this bread and brings this offering together and sets it there. And then it says that the angel of the Lord came and he lit the fire and took up the offering. And it consumed the whole offering. And it was a sign of showing that God was powerful enough to be with him and reassured him of that. But of course, in the process of doing that, took away all of his livelihood in his offering. And what it does, though, is it gives him a little bit of reassurance and tells him to focus not upon himself, but upon God. And so trusting in oneself results in the fear of failure. Philippians chapter 3, verse 3 says this, For we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit and rejoice in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. Though I also might have confidence in the flesh, if anyone else thinks he has confidence in the flesh, I more so. And then Paul goes in and talks about all the confidence he has in the flesh by being of the tribe of Benjamin or tribe of the Pharisee of Pharisees and all this kind of stuff. And he goes in, but then he says, all of that is nothing. I give it all up because of my relationship with Christ. Galatians 5 verse 10 says, I have confidence in you in the Lord. So the only way Paul was able to have confidence in someone else or in the personhood of somebody else was knowing that the Lord was working in and through them. The only way that we can have confidence in our ability to do anything is knowing that God is working in and through us. The only way that we can have confidence in our spouse to be able to do what they need to do is to know that God is working in them. The only way that we can have confidence that our children will be raised up in faith is not the ability that we have to be able to teach them or the ability that we have to be parents. Mm-mm. The only way that we can have confidence is to believe that God is working in and through them. If God doesn't work in and through them, we can have absolutely no confidence at all. We're just like Gideon, who comes before the angel of the Lord and says, me? I'm the weakest. How in the world? But when we turn our eyes to the Lord, that's when we're able to have the confidence that we need to have. Properly placed faith must replace our faith, our fear. We acquire faith through the knowledge of who God is and what he has done in the past and what he promises to do in the future. We must learn his word so that our faith might be built up. Step out in faith, not in yourself, but in God. And then number three, divine fear results in peace with God. Divine fear results in peace with God or from God. We see this in verses 19 through verse 24. So Gideon here, after he has this encounter with the angel, or as he's having this encounter with the angel, it says, so Gideon went to prepare the young goat, the unleavened bread from the ephah of the flour, the meat put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought them to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. So this is an act of hospitality, an act of worship, as he brings this offering before the angel of the Lord. Verse 20, and the angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire arose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. That is, he was God in the flesh. Now this was another occurrence of a theophany or a Christophany. I mentioned these once before. A theophany is the presence of God manifested as an angel. Or Christophany is the presence of Christ manifested as an angel. And the reason that we have an indication this is actually what this is because we have angels coming to men. But when an angel comes to men, they don't receive any worship. In fact, they refuse worship because they know that only worship is to be belonged to God. But when an angel of the Lord or the angel of the Lord comes, he receives worship. And so that would be an indication that this is a theophany or a Christophany. Verse 22, now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. So Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." In other words, what he's saying, look, I did something you're not supposed to do. I saw the Lord face to face. That means I'm going to die. Verse 23, then the Lord said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." Now, the reason he was able to say that is because Gideon had a proper fear of God. Had he entered before God and said, "You're just God," would have been done with him. But because he had a proper fear of God, he had a divine fear of God, he was able to have peace with God. Same thing says in the New Testament. We read this. It says in 1 John chapter 4, verse 17, "Love has been perfected among us in this, that we have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so we are in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment, but he who fears has not been made perfect in love." And Romans chapter 5, verse 1 says, "Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ." It is through the process of justification that we are able to have peace with God. And how is it that we are justified? We are justified when we fear God. We're justified when we have a proper respect and understanding of who God is as the God of gods, the King of kings, and the Lord of lords. And we understand that we ourselves are humbled in His sight because of our sin. And then we transfer that faith into Him. You see, the problem, the fear of God, is the key to the solution, peace with God. And this occurs in other avenues, not just spiritually, but it occurs in other situations in life as well. Often, the problem itself is the solution to the problem. You think for a moment of gardening. And a lot of us have a lot of weeds come up in our garden, right? Well, did you know that weeds are actually God's solution to the problem? You might think about, how in the world is that possible? Because weeds come up only when there is barren soil. And barren soil is a problem because it washes away and erosion and, you know, all kinds of problems. So when you have the ground covered, that's not a problem anymore. And so the weeds come up to cover the ground. And so the weeds themselves are actually a solution to the problem. Now, we try to get rid of the solution to the problem and try to, you know, do all kinds of other stuff to do it. And you can do that. But in this case, the actual fear of God is the solution to the problem of fear of God. And that is that we have peace with God. Fear of God is healthy, and we should have this tension between fearing God and resting in His peace that He provides through Christ. So number three is divine fear results in peace from God. Number four, then, is man-induced fear results in hindered witness. Man-induced fear results in hindered witness. So he has this relationship with this angel of the Lord, and the angel of the Lord commissions him to go and to lead the people of Israel out. And in verse 25, we read this. "Now it came to pass that same night that the Lord said to him, 'Take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden image that is beside it.'" So he's asking him to go and destroy the gods that have been raised up as an offense to the Lord. Verse 26, "And build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you shall cut down." So verse 27, it says, "So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Lord had said to him." And you get that famous word right there. "But because he feared his father's household and the men in the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. Now, we have to give him a little bit of credit here. At least he did it. There's some of us who, if we were asked to do something similar and we knew that it was going to be the loss of our job or be ostracized from our family or to lose all of our wealth, we would say, I'm not doing that. So at least he did it. But he had still a little bit of fear of man in him to where he had to do it at night so that they wouldn't see him doing it. Now, do you think God would have protected him if he did it during the day? Yep. But he had just a little bit of fear in him. And so he did it during the night. Man-induced fear results in a hindered witness. I wonder what kind of witness he would have had he done this during the day. For everybody to see, what in the world is Gideon doing? He's tearing down the altar of Baal. Let's go try to kill him. So all the worshipers of Baal try to go and kill him, but they can't kill him because the Lord protects him. What kind of witness would that be? A lot better witness than what he had. Now, he did have a witness. Let's read what it says in verses 28 through 32. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down, and the wooden image that was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. So they said to one another, "Who has done this thing?" And when they had inquired and asked, they said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing." Then the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it." But Joash said, now this is great. I like this part. But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Would you plead for Baal?" So that shows you the kind of power in Baal, right? That Gideon's able to go and cut down this image of Baal. If Baal was so strong, couldn't Baal prevent him from cutting it down? Of course. And so Joash basically says, look, if your God's so powerful that he can't even prevent Gideon from cutting it down, then let your God deal with it. Would you save him? Verse 31, let one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because he has an altar that's been torn down. Verse 32, therefore on that day he called him Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him, because he has torn down his altar. So he gets renamed. What about that for a witness? He gets renamed Jerubbaal. In other words, let Baal contend with him, because he was contending with Baal. Now, how many of us have been renamed because of our witness? Not too many, huh? So we have to give Gideon some credit here. But how much greater would it have been had he not feared man? And I wonder what witness that we are missing out on, what kind of impact that we are missing out on because we do not step out in faith when God calls us to step out in faith and to witness, even if it means the persecution of men. We must be bold. We must not miss out on having the huge impact because we have feared what others might say or what others might think. Galatians chapter 1 verse 10 says, for do I now persuade men, this is Paul speaking, or God? Or do I seek to please men? For if I still pleased men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. Now that doesn't mean if your pastor comes over for dinner that you don't try to please him with good food. Okay, that's not what I'm saying, okay? What I'm saying from this scripture and what Paul is saying is that when it comes down to pleasing men or pleasing God, we always choose pleasing God. We should not be afraid of men. Matthew 10 verse 28 says it this way. Jesus is speaking. He says, and do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. What if we were called upon to be a witness for God, to testify of the faith with a gun at our head? Would we do it? Jesus says, do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That's whom we should fear. And then number 5, skeptical fear results in testing God. Skeptical fear results in testing God. So after Gideon has been bold enough to witness before the people of Baal, the worshipers of Baal, he's still not fully convinced that God is going to be on his side. He's a little bit skeptical still. And so we read in verse 33, "Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. Then he blew the trumpet, and the Abiezrites gathered behind him. And he sent messengers throughout Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. And he also sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came to meet them. So Gideon said to God, 'If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said.'" Now, why didn't he believe? What was the problem? Why did he get this skepticism over him after God had just done these great things through him, and after he had just been told by God that he was going to be with him? Well, because he saw the Amalekites and the Midianites gathering in the valley of Jezreel. And he called and hollered for all of his people to gather around him. And when he looked at them, he said, 30,000? 150,000. Not so good odds. And so he thinks, well, does God really want me? If God would want me to go after them, he needs to gain me a bigger army. And so he gets this skepticism, this doubt arise in him. And so he begins to ask God, and he says, "God, if you really want me to go out against these people, you got to give me another sign." And so he says, "I'm going to put this fleece on the ground. And if the ground around it is dry and the fleece is wet, then I'll know for sure that you're going to be with me." And so he puts the fleece out, and sure enough, the next morning he wakes up and he's able to wring the fleece out with water. It's got so much water in it. And all around it, it's dry. But that's still not good enough, is it? We read that he says, "God, if it's possible for me to ask one more request, I know that it's possible for that to happen naturally. By chance, the dew is able to condescend onto the fleece and not on the ground and dried up on the ground because of the sand. And so it's possible that was a natural event. So this is what I need you to do now, God. I need you to do just the opposite. I need you to make all the ground wet and the fleece dry." And so he petitions God again out of skepticism. And God, out of his grace, meets the test again. The next morning when he wakes up, Gideon goes out there and the fleece is dry and the ground all around him is totally saturated wet. So now he has some confidence. He knows that God means what he says. And so he is willing to go out before the enemies. Skeptical fear results in testing God. When we are skeptical about what God says, when we begin to doubt what he says, what do we want to do? We want to do the same thing Gideon did. We want to test him. If you're really there, God, if you really want me to do this, God, then do this. How many of y'all have prayed a prayer like that? I have. When I was unsaved, I was in the process of being saved. God was working in my heart. I was a teenager in high school and looking forward to go to college. And I knew that I had some questions about life and reality and the world and that were unanswered. And I didn't have an answer for them. And I was really searching God. And I must have prayed this prayer 100 times. "God, if you're real, make yourself known to me." You ever prayed that prayer? That's in a form of testing God, isn't it? He said he's real in his word, hasn't he? And yet there needs to be this skepticism confirmed in our lives so often. And the same thing is true with Gideon. He told Gideon, "I will be with you." But Gideon says, "Not quite enough, God. I need something else. I need some confirmation." And just as it was with Gideon, God was gracious enough to me to take the test. Revealed himself to me. Now, he didn't reveal himself to me some, you know, voice from heaven or anything like that. He revealed himself through me, through the scriptures, as I got into a Bible study. He began to reveal himself to me, and the truth became plain. How many of y'all have heard of foxhole conversions? People who have been in the midst of war and battle and shells going off all around them. And they pray, God, if you will get me out of this, I'll serve the rest of my life. Some of you probably maybe even prayed that prayer. World War II or Korea or something like that. I remember a friend of mine from seminary is one of our professors who has got a remarkable testimony about when he was in Korea. And he had lied to get into the army because he had grew up in a horrible family life and he thought the army was the way for him to get out. So he lied about his age, 17, enlisted, and got sent to Korea. And his whole company was destroyed. He was shot and basically left dead in a foxhole. Thought he was going to die. And freezing cold, laying there in that foxhole, he prayed out to God and said, God, if you will deliver me from this, I'll serve you the rest of my life. Well, it ended up that the enemies found him in that foxhole, and they were going through making rounds, making sure that everybody in them was dead. They turned him over. He's still somewhat conscious, and they take a firearm to his head and shoot. By God's grace, it ricochets, goes by the side of his head, and around out the back. He does not flinch because it's so cold. He doesn't feel it. And they throw him back down. He goes unconscious. The next people that find him are Allied forces. And they take him to the hospital and he recovers. And to this day, he is a professor of evangelism, serving the Lord. He tested God. God showed himself faithful. And he was able to be delivered. And so he served the Lord. Same thing held true with Gideon. Gideon was skeptical. He tested God. God showed himself faithful. And so he then followed the Lord wholeheartedly. And then we see the sixth principle, the sixth truth. And that is circumstantial fear results in the glory for God. Circumstantial fear results in glory for God. We see this in chapter 7. Beginning in verse 1, it says, then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod. So the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give to the Midianites into their hands. Let Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. So remember how we had 30,000 against 150,000 on the battlefield? Well, God thought that was too good odds. He thought that if Israel destroyed the Midianites at that point, that they would be able to take glory for themselves. And so what he says, anybody who's afraid, send them home, Gideon. 22,000 of the 30 are sent home, leaving only 10,000, 8,000 or so of the 30,000. And so now it's 10,000 basically to this, or 8,000 basically to this 150,000 mass of Amalekites and Midianites. And as a result of the fear of the people, God was able to be more fully glorified. Because it showed more so that it was certainly God that was at work. But then in verses 9 through 14, we also see that through the fear of the Amalekites, God was able to receive even more glory. Because the story goes on, I read it already, so I'm not going to read it, I'll just tell it to you. But Gideon goes down the camp because he's afraid to go against Israel once again. And so God says, I'll give you this one condition. If you go down with your servant and you go and you listen to what's going on down at the camp, you'll get some intel that will be able to tell you that they're just afraid of you as you are of them. And so they go down to the camp, and on the outskirts of the camp, they listen. And there are some guards that are talking. And they're saying, you know, I had this dream last night. And in this dream, this barley loaf rolled down this hill and took out our tent. or took out this tent. And of course, the guy next to him says, oh man, you know what that is? That's a sign that Gideon's going to come in here and kill us all off. And Gideon hears this. This is the enemy's talking. And so he's able to gain some encouragement. And it was because of the fear of Gideon and because of the fear of the people that God again is shown more glory. Now, of course, barley would be a perfect representation of Gideon because that's all that they were eating. They couldn't afford anything else because everything else was being destroyed. And, of course, the tent, these were just the Amalekites and all who were tent Bedouins running around with their camels and tents and all. And so, in case the fear of the Midianites and Amalekites encouraged Gideon to the point that he was able to worship in verse 15 and then go back to the 300 that were left after the other ones had been weeded away because they had weeded out some more for the 8,000. So now down to 300 men. And he goes back and he encourages them and says, all right, God has proven himself again. Let's go get him. So now you have 300 men against 150,000 men. That's the odds. And yet Gideon is ready to go in the fight against them. Trust in the Lord when the circumstances are that cause you to fear, and you'll see the glory of God manifested. Consider fearful circumstances opportunity for God to show his glory. And then finally, irrational fear results in destruction. Irrational fear results in destruction. So here's the battle plans, beginning in verse 15 of chapter 7. We see Gideon giving everybody a lantern and everybody a horn. All 300. He says, all right, this is what our plan is. We're going to go and we're going to surround in three companies. We're going to surround the Amalekites and the Midianites. And you just watch for the signal. And when the signal is done, we're going to take away whatever is covering our lantern. And we're going to blow on our trumpets, which is basically a ram's horn. We're going to blow on our horns. And we're going to shout, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And as soon as you shout that, you just watch for the glory of God. That's their battle plan. Way to go, Gideon. Well, sure enough, what do? They separate into three different companies. They go and they surround the Amalekites and the Midianites. And then at the signal, Gideon breaks the lantern so that the light shines. He blows the horn and he says, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And what happens? Says the Amalekites and the Midianites were so afraid and so much in chaos. They had such irrational fear that they began to fight each other, thinking that they were the Gideonites. The people of Gideon. Now it happened to be, as it says in the scriptures, that they were at a change of guard. And so as one guard group was leaving, the other guard group was coming out. And so the timing was such that they probably thought the guards leaving were the enemy forces coming in. And so they fought with one another and they killed each other off. So here we have Gideon's army, the 300 men, with horn in one hand and lantern in the other, standing around watching the Amalekites and the Midianites kill each other off with swords. How's that for a battle plan? See, irrational fear results in destruction. The Amalekites and the Midianites had irrational fear. As a result, they ended up destroying themselves. You see, we see this in other things, not just spiritually, not just in this case, but we see this in life as well. How many times have we seen this in the stock market? People have irrational fear of the market tanking, and so they pull their money out, and of course that just results in the market tanking even further and getting all scared. Some of the news article came out around the panics of 1929, and the stock market panic there, and the stock market panic in the 80s, and the stock market panic that we just recently went through with the housing bubble and all this kind of stuff, and everybody's all afraid, and as a result of that and the result of the panic, wealth is destroyed. You see, panic, irrational fear, always results in destruction. I think of the time of Herod. New Testament. Remember Herod in the New Testament? During the time of Jesus, after he was born, and the wise men come to him and say, where is the child that's to be born king of Israel? And Herod gets afraid with irrational fear. And so what does he do? Goes off and destroys every child 2 years old and younger. Irrational fear results in destruction. It was said of Herod because he ended up poisoning all of his family out of irrational fear that they might take the throne from him. It was said that it would be better to be a pig in Herod's household than one of his sons. Because he wouldn't kill pigs, because he didn't eat pigs. But he'd kill you as a son. That's irrational fear. It results in destruction. We must not panic in fear, because it will result in destruction. We must be careful to avoid those who are acting with irrational fear, because we might be the people who are destroyed. So verses 24 and 25 summarize what took place at the end. Then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and seize from them the watering places as far as Beth-Bera to the Jordan." Then all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Beth-Bera to the Jordan. And they captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. And they pursued the Midianites and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to the Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. Chapter 8 then goes on and explains their continued pursuit and the continued destruction of the Midianites and Amalekites. God delivered them, just as he had promised, from the oppression that was around them. So idolatrous fear results in the discipline from God. Trusting in oneself results in the fear of failure. Divine fear results in peace from God. Man-induced fear results in hindered witness. Skeptical fear results in testing God. Circumstantial fear results in glory for God. And irrational fear results in destruction. Let us pray.
And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
What would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change